Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. It's September 16th, 2006, just a little more than 7 weeks until the midterm elections. Joining me on the show this afternoon will be Jeffrey Steinberg, who's a frequent guest on our show. Jeff is one of the editors of the Executive Intelligence Review and a longtime collaborator of Lyndon LaRouche. Jeff has written articles which provide unique coverage of the unfolding strategic events and crises, and his articles are widely circulated, appearing in newspapers and on websites from Russia to the Middle East to India, and of course throughout the United States. Now today we're going to be discussing the developments in the aftermath of Lyndon LaRouche's September 6th webcast. And there are 2 points in particular from the webcast that I'd like to start with, and then beyond that, we have a number of extremely important issues to pick up on. But the two we'll start with is, one, the urgent significance of removing President Bush and Vice President Cheney from office immediately. And then secondly, in order to do that, the need for a dramatic reorientation of the Democratic Party away from the direction pushed by the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, the neocons in the Democratic Party, who have pushed the party to take up the concerns of the upper 20% of family income brackets in the tradition of Harry Truman, that we have to break with that tradition and return to the outlook and policies of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So those will be the two topics we'll take a look at initially. We'll be joined later by two panelists from the LaRouche Youth Movement, Dennis Dalton in Houston, Texas, and Ed Hamler, who's with us in Boston. So, Jeff, let's start with the person Lyndon LaRouche has described as that poor bum President Bush. Yesterday he gave a truly shocking performance in a White House press conference. He was clearly rattled by some of the questions. He gave belligerent, defiant, and only marginally coherent answers in which he defended not only the Iraq War, but his policies of torture, secret prisons, and illegal wiretapping. On September 11th, Lyndon LaRouche issued a call for the immediate impeachment of Bush and Cheney. Jeff, what's going on with Bush, and do you think his wildly irrational behavior will facilitate moves for impeachment?
Well, I think we really passed an inflection point in this whole impeachment process over the last several days. If people recall back in the early 1970s, and the impeachment of Richard Nixon. It was only at the point that members of Nixon's own party came around to the conclusion that Nixon was a menace and had to be removed from office, that the impeachment actually moved forward and actually resulted in Nixon's resignation. This past week, around exactly this issue of torture, secret prisons, and the procedures the White House is trying to push for trying the so-called terrorists and enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay, pushed the Republican Party, a number of important Republicans, over the edge. And there's now, for the first time, momentum among the Republicans themselves over the issue that both Bush and Cheney are going to have to go.
So it's not just distancing. You actually see that some of these, around the Warner, McCain, Lindsey, and other issues, that people are ready to dump Bush to save the nation.
I can give you two anecdotes from inside the cloakroom on Capitol Hill. I was up on the Hill for a whole series of meetings yesterday, and this is coming from Republicans. Number one, a growing number of conservative Republicans, traditional conservatives, who are deeply disturbed by the assault on the Constitution, the disrespect for the institution of Congress, and flagrant criminality on the part of Bush and Cheney, are openly saying that they are now prepared to vote yes if an impeachment resolution is presented before the House.
And I assume, Jeff, these are people who have talked with Bush and Cheney, have tried to reason with them to no avail.
Right. The other report, in fact, goes exactly to that point. On Thursday, just before the Senate vote on the proposed revisions in the torture policy, Bush went up to Capitol Hill and had a closed-door meeting with all of the House Republicans. And in that meeting, I don't know the name of the congressman, but a very senior, well-known Republican congressman commented to President Bush that if his White House legislation were to be passed, it would mean that the United States would be the only country in the world where an individual could be arrested, jailed, tried, convicted, and executed without ever being given the opportunity to respond to the evidence against him. And when the congressman asked Bush if he was prepared to bring the United States into that situation of global isolation, Bush went nuts. And if you saw the press conference he gave yesterday in the Rose Garden, he was completely berserk on these questions, threatening Congress that they were becoming enemies in the war on terror if they did not allow the CIA to continue with certain torture practices. Now, the CIA itself, senior people have said they want to get out of this. They were ordered by the Pentagon and the White House to engage in this. They're not comfortable with it either. So the thrust is coming from the White House, and leading members of Congress are now on the Republican side of the aisle, seeing that this is not a partisan issue, but this is an issue of the survival of our constitutional structure. Yesterday, General John Vesey, mm-hmm. former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, one of the most respected retired military officers, spent 48 years in military service, wrote a letter that was released publicly.
He was a Reagan appointee as
Correct.
Chairman of the Joint
exactly.
Chiefs. Yeah.
Sent a letter and basically said, I've been through tough wars. This country's been through tough wars, and we fought against the Nazis, but we never resorted to these kinds of tactics that the White House is proposing. This is a threat to our identity as a nation. On the Keith Olbermann show the other night, law professor Jonathan Turley said that he could document 20 separate felony crimes committed by Bush and Cheney in the NSA surveillance program alone. And he said that the phase change took place in 1789 when we established our constitutional framework. That's who we are as a nation, who we are as a people, and Bush is violating all of that. So I think that we're at a phase shift, and you pointed to the statement that Mr. LaRouche issued at the beginning of this week.
Right.
That statement is circulating in a 250,000 run leaflet that's being distributed all over the United States. It's already saturated Capitol Hill and all the environs of Washington. And I think that this has been a driver. The timing could not have been more perfect. And you have a White House that is desperate, that is displaying a degree of criminal mentality that's dangerous to the country and the world.
You're listening to Jeff Steinberg from the Executive Intelligence Review. This is the LaRouche Show. We will take your emails. We'll be glad to take email questions for Jeff. You can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And we'll be joined in a little while with members of the LaRouche Youth Movement. But, Jeff, I want to go just a little bit deeper into this question of the unhinged nature of Cheney and Bush right now. I saw the press conference yesterday, and I wasn't sure that Bush wasn't about to jump off the podium and attack some of these reporters physically. he was so unhinged. But at one point, he was saying that the professionals are asking for the tools to do the job, so we have to clarify Common Article 3 of the Geneva Code. That's what he wants to do. And it seems as though that's not what he wants to do. He wants to violate it. He wants the rights to violate it. You talk to a lot of people in the intelligence community, the military. Has the consensus shifted dramatically among this network as well?
For the military, especially speaking through the retired senior military, it's been their view for a long time that Bush and Cheney are a threat to the national security of the United States. They virtually destroyed the armed forces.
This was brought up by Representative Murtha the other day in a press conference.
Exactly. And as everybody knows, Murtha is one of the people in Congress who spent 30 years in the military and has been up on the Hill for an equal amount of time. And he is in direct contact continuously with active duty military people. His own position is, I think, the ranking Dem on military appropriations. Means that he's got to have constant interaction with the uniformed military, and he very much speaks for them. I think it's also noteworthy that former Secretary of State and former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell, weighed in a letter to John McCain midweek opposing this torture policy. It was not only a stunning break by a former very high-ranking official of this administration, but it was also widely read as a signal that what was formerly called the Bush 41, Bush Senior apparatus, has decisively broken with the White House. That's not only Colin Powell, it's Brent Scowcroft, perhaps even James Baker. But that whole apparatus, through Powell, signaled that this faction within the Republican Party is no longer supporting the administration. And, of course, you had 25 flag officers, retirees, generals and admirals, writing a letter also opposing the Bush administration's proposals on abrogating the Geneva Convention and continuing with the torture and the proposals they've got for the trials, which fall well outside international law. So the military has been in a leading position of opposition through these retirees and through people like Murtha up on the Hill who actually speak for the active duty military.
So it's unquestionable that within the institutions there has been a desertion of the administration. There's a brawl underway. So that brings us to the second question that was at the center of Lyndon LaRouche's discussion in his webcast, which is, what about the American people? Are they merely bystanders? Are they starting to get it? Well, Lynn pointed to the election on Tuesday, the election results in the primaries on Tuesday, to say that these results vindicated his rebuke to the Democrats at the webcast that you have to reject Truman and go with Franklin Roosevelt. So give us a little picture of what happened on Tuesday and how that vindicated what Mr. LaRouche said at the webcast.
Well, you know, primary elections, traditionally you'll get only the most hardcore activist Democrats generally turning out, but it's also usually a pretty good measuring rod of where the core Democratic voters stand with respect to the party leadership. And overwhelmingly, opposition candidates who were running as insurgents against the party-backed candidates either won the primary elections outright or came extremely close. In Maryland, Congressman Albert Wynn, who's been in Congress for 14 years, is still in a contested election. Wynn is one of these guys who, although in the Black Caucus, has tended to align with the DLC crowd. And he's never had a serious primary challenge before. So that's one of the indicators. You've got four retired young military personnel ran and won their primary elections in different parts of the country. And generally speaking, the two critical issues on people's minds were war and the impeachment of Bush and Cheney.
Just on that last point, before we get to the economy, which is the other issue, there was one of the most telling elections was the primary up in New Hampshire, where the Democratic Congressional Committee had endorsed and funded a moderate Democrat by the name of Craig, who had $190-something thousand to spend in the race, and he had an opponent, a woman whose main issue was set a timetable to withdraw. She only had $19,000, so it was a 10-to-1 spending advantage toward the so-called moderate Democrat, and yet she defeated him and won the primary.
Exactly. And look, the Iraq issue is more than the Iraq issue. People who are committed to the idea that we've got to get out of Iraq, we've got to have an immediate exit strategy, are also very cognizant of the fact that the administration is pushing the drums of war on Iran. So it's not only the ongoing Iraq war that's on people's mind, it's also the fact that they know that lunatics Bush and Cheney are seriously considering a military action against Iran. And I should add that nobody among the professional military intelligence and diplomatic community contacts who I've spoken with in the last week in the least are prepared to rule out a air assault against Iran before the November elections.
That's one of the options for an October surprise.
Correct, exactly.
Well, and there's no one in the world at this point who would support that except the president and his sociopathic sidekick, Dick Cheney. But, Jeff, let's just go to the economy quickly on this, because this also gets at this point of Truman versus Roosevelt, and also at the question of the vindication of LaRouche. We were there in February 2005 when Lyndon LaRouche put out the call that there be emergency action to protect and defend the auto sector, and over the course of a year, this became refined in a package of legislation around retooling auto with U.S. federal credit. And not just for the auto sector, but to save the machine tool sector, which is needed for infrastructure as well as military production. The Democratic Party chose not to go with LaRouche on this, gave every excuse in the book. And just this last Friday, yesterday, there was the announcement at Ford of job cuts, plant closings. Chrysler is in terminal crisis. General Motors cutting 30,000 jobs. How does this play into the picture? You said it's not just the war. How is the economy being read by people in Washington as an issue?
Well, I think the point is that the economy is being read by the population as an absolute disaster, and that the directionality of the Bush administration on economic policy has been as bad as their Iraq policy. Now, yesterday I was at an event in Washington. It was an afternoon four-hour seminar of the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution, and there were people like former Treasury Secretary Rubin, former Assistant Deputy Secretary Treasury Roger Altman, Laura Tyson, who was the head of the Council of Economic Advisers under Clinton, and they all clearly recognized the magnitude of the problem, but they don't have the kind of depth of understanding of what LaRouche talks about when he discusses dynamics in the economy. And LaRouche commented earlier today that to really understand where we are economically at this moment, the crisis that we're in, the deep, profound collapse of our core industry, our infrastructure, our science policy, you do really have to go back to this Truman versus Roosevelt question. And he said some things that I wanted to convey here because I found them extremely thought-provoking.
Well, and this is very important because what the fault line, in a sense, within the Democratic Party was a quite sharp reaction to what Mr. LaRouche said in particular on this Truman-Roosevelt issue. So, yeah, please give us the latest.
Well, what Lynn said is he said, look, FDR had a plan for the post-war world, and it centered on, number one, bringing an end to colonialism worldwide. That at the end of the war, the economic and political power of the United States, had Roosevelt lived, would have forced our European allies in the war to abandon their colonial empires. As you know, the fault line between Roosevelt and Churchill was that Churchill wanted to defeat Hitler in order to make sure that the British remained supreme in a global system of colonies.
Precisely.
But more concretely, Roosevelt's plan was to convert the war debt into credit for the economic development of the newly liberated countries of the post-colonial period right after the war. And his understanding was that the industrial might of the United States that had been mobilized to defeat Hitler could be retooled immediately and would provide the necessary industrial output to launch these development projects, and that you were going to have a Hamiltonian approach to the post-war world based on using American economic strength to rebuild Europe and Japan, but also to build the economies of the newly liberated independent countries of Africa, South America, parts of Asia. And when Roosevelt died and Truman came in, what did we get instead? We got the Cold War. And therefore, all of that direction of economic capacity and the potential for turning the debt into fungible instruments of credit was lost. We went through a second downshift, major downshift, in 1971 with the end of the Bretton Woods system, at which point radical free trade, what's now called globalization, took over. And as the result, we have now reached the end of a cycle where the collapse of the world financial system, the collapse of physical production, has brought us to the point that the same people who engineered the policy change after Roosevelt's death under Truman are now once again going for fascism and war. That's the real significance of both this administration, the Bush-Cheney administration, and those within the Democratic Party who want to insist that Truman can cohabitate with FDR, or that Truman is the true legacy of the post-war Democratic Party.
And I want to draw this out in just a second, but I want to call our listeners' attention to the fact that the webcast pamphlet, the transcript of Lyndon LaRouche's September 6, 2006 webcast, is available now, and you can get it. I'll give you the number now, and I'll give it again. This is the LaRouche Pack line, and it's a LaRouche Pack publication. It's 800-929-7566. 800-929-7566. And you can get the transcript of the webcast, including the totally fascinating question and answer session that took place afterwards from LaRouche's address in Berlin. Now, Jeff, the reaction then, here you have an irony. You have the Hamilton Project, which clearly should be oriented toward FDR. You have a number of Democrats who don't go along with the DLC. In fact, a Democrat defeated DLC poster boy Joe Lieberman. The Democratic Leadership Council would seem to be on the butt end of the Democratic Party right now, given the fact that they are supporting Bush, supporting the war. So why is it that there's still a problem of this Truman cohabiting in the Democratic Party with the FDR tradition?
Well, you got two problems. One problem is the orientation towards the pocketbooks of the upper 3%.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the upper 10 or 20% income bracket people who orient to the upper 3% as their role models. And if you've got the Democratic Party convinced that rather than mobilizing the lower 80%, you've got to mobilize the checkbooks of the upper 20 or upper 3%, then you have an element of flat-out corruption that will render the Democratic Party the party of losers. The second factor, and this is a more challenging problem, from among those people, particularly among some of the senior people from the Clinton administration, who are well-meaning and who want to do something and who see that all of the axioms of the Bush administration's economic policy are dead wrong. Among these people, even among the very, very best, and I got this sense very clearly yesterday, they really don't, they have not mastered Lynn's concepts mm-hmm. of the economy. And I discussed that at some length with Mr. LaRouche today. And he agreed. He said, look, the recent paper that he did, which is the appendix to the pamphlet on the September 6th webcast, mm-hmm. Dynamics and Economy, is the critical issue. And Lynn today laid out the three building blocks, the three key factors in their interrelationship that defines a successful economic recovery for the United States and the world today. Number one, production. You have to go back to a producer economy. And Lynn said, this is an easy thing to do if you're just willing to restructure your tax policy.
Mm-hmm.
Make it excruciatingly painful for somebody to put their money into post-industrial programs.
Mm-hmm.
And pile on the incentives for people to invest in the buildup of domestic high-technology industry.
Okay.
Secondly, the level and quality of infrastructure determines the productivity of the economy. And right now, we have an economy that is so overwhelmingly oriented towards useless employment in the service sector that the overhead costs on the productive sector of the economy are killing everything. And so if you look across the country, most geographic areas and most of the population are engaged in unproductive work, those that even have jobs. So this idea of rebuilding our hard and soft infrastructure, high-speed rail, energy systems, water management, put people to work.
Jeff, we're going to have to just stop here for a quick break, and we'll come right back to this third point.
Great.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, September 16th, 2006. If you'd like to make sure your friends hear this, this show is going to be archived. You can find it on the LaRouchePub.com website, which is should be your homepage in any case. So you can get the latest from Mr. LaRouche and the battles that he's leading precisely on these questions that Jeff is discussing. So it's LaRouchePub.com. You can scroll over to the left-hand side, and you'll see The LaRouche Show. We have an archive. This show will be archived along with all of the shows we've done for the last years. Now, to get literature, to get the transcript of the webcast from September 6th, call us at 800-929-7566. Tell them you heard this on The LaRouche Show. We'll send you a copy, or if you really want to organize, if you're committed to getting Bush and Cheney out and you don't know what to do, well, don't just sit there and Google and sign things on a website. Go out and organize. Talk to people. Take up the process of being a real citizen, of helping your fellow citizens become potently involved in the political process. So you can get the material you need at 800-929-7566, and you can contribute on that number if you'd like to also. Now, we're coming back to the show, and I'm going to bring in the panel in just a moment. But, Jeff, you were identifying the three factors that Lynn identified for an economic recovery. First one is production, put people back to work in a producer economy. Second one, the importance of infrastructure to facilitate that kind of development. And what was point number three?
There has to be a science driver policy. Otherwise, there's no capacity for real long-term growth in the economy. And Lynn emphasized that the science driver is emphatically not information theory and information technology. So basically, infrastructure and the science driver. And that will create a fundamental shift in the dynamics of the economy.
Well, and that's exactly what the task of the LaRouche Youth Movement is right now with this recent reinauguration of the animations policy. And so let me use this as an opportunity to bring in our LaRouche Youth Movement panelists here. First, let's hear from Ed Hamler. Ed, you were just in Washington, D.C. for the Week of Action. What did you come back with as a sense of the possibility?
Well, I think to a large extent, me personally and a number of my friends here came back with a different sense of what we actually represented as a youth movement. Obviously, the perspective that Lynn laid out was very challenging because what you immediately see is Lynn in a dialogue with these nations around the world, but also our role in that, trying to think about the challenges Lynn's been bringing up to us. One of those challenges has been to think of ourselves in terms of solarians, that in order to really deal with the kind of challenges Lynn was laying out around discussion with these nations, that you're going to have people that actually know how to develop the solar system for very practical needs that are going to be needed between collaboration between these countries. So that was one crucial thing that they got to think about changing our conception of ourselves. But also Lynn's challenge on the animations, which you just brought up, on the beginning of that process is going to be not only the reintroduction of the method of spherics, which has been totally wiped out by most universities today, but also the advancement of Lynn's science of physical economics. And the beginning, one of the beginning branching points in that is the construction of computer animations to animate Kepler's discovery of universal gravitation so that we can rapidly work people through the reliving of this crucial discovery and to begin to intervene in that way.
Now, Ed, you were involved in some lobbying in the past. I know with the first round of animations that we did, we brought in computers and showed congressional offices the rate of collapse of healthcare, the auto sector. Do you think this is the way we're going to be able to catch the attention and actually affect the change that Jeff was just talking about in the legislators?
Yeah, I think that's one aspect of it. But I also think that the more crucial aspect of us having gone through reliving, because I think that the differences with the animations that we're doing right now with Kepler in particular is really, you know, what is a universal principle? How do you come to know that? What's the method by which you come to know that? And then how do you demonstrate that principle to another human being? And I think we're getting a very sensual or a sensuous sense of that with the kind of animation that we're doing now. I think the work in the Congress will improve as we improve our minds. And then I'm sort of waiting with bated breath to get to the economics. Lynn sort of laid out an entire curriculum that we're going to be going through maybe before we get to a lot of the hardcore economics, but Nevertheless, I think the crucial breakthrough now is the increased capability of demonstrating principles of economics, and not just reiterating things that people sort of have a sense of.
Well, you know, the principle of economics comes from precisely the mastery of the ability to hypothesize and discover universal physical principles, and this is why the Kepler work is so crucial and interesting. We also have Dennis Dalton on the line. I know, Dennis, you've been doing some of the work on Kepler, so you may have some comments on that, or on the organizing going on in Texas, where there are some interesting election races here. I mean, what's your sense of the population? Is there a turn taking place in Bush's home state on the question of the war and the economy? Dennis, you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry, I had my phone muted.
Okay, go ahead.
We definitely have a shift in the population here in Texas where, like, for instance, last night I was speaking with a gentleman that is he's a candidate on the Republican side for the state legislature, and he was desperately concerned about the collapsing housing bubble, and because he's a real estate agent as his first job, because the reps here are not in session yearly. So he had a certain sense that this economy is not in good shape, but he as Jeff was stating, he didn't have a real sense of what to do to solve the problems. And we're getting that more and more commonly here on the streets in Houston. I know what I've been getting from people that are going up to Austin. You have a definite hotbed of activity there where people are itching for the impeachment of Bush. They're itching to get out of this war. And that's the type of activity we see more and more here. One of the things that I witnessed at the Democratic Party about a week ago was that on confronted with a real offensive idea of how the Democrats could sweep these elections, they tend to pull back, and they're kind of afraid to take the offensive stance. I don't know if it's just been so long for them since they've been in that position, but it's going to take a lot of fighting with the Democrats to get them to recognize that it's more fun to be offensive.
Well, did you in your discussions? I know you were very much involved in the campaign to unseat Tom DeLay last time. Now there's a chance to win that seat, but you're saying that you think that they're still holding back. Have you had a chance to start talking about this Truman-FDR question with Democrats?
We've brought that up in the last couple of days because of what Lynn did with this webcast, and I really haven't had a chance to talk to the actual candidates or the Democratic Party officials, but we've introduced it to the population, and people seem to have a certain idea that that what Truman did, like with dropping these bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was not necessarily the most proper thing, but there still seems to be people's attachments to, well, it saved a million lives and these types of lines that were put out there. But I haven't had a real opportunity, to speak to some of the politicians and the candidates themselves about this.
Jeff, as is often the case in something that Lynn brings up, it's clear that we're going against the traditional lying history that's become acceptable. For example, on Truman, many Democrats think, they'll say, well, in order to compete with the Republicans on security matters and defense matters, we have to go to Truman. Just summarize why that's wrong.
Well, first of all, go back to the Kerry campaign. Kerry lost the election in the month of August because, confronted with a McCarthyite slur campaign that was run through this Swift Boat veterans dirty tricks operation, his knees buckled and he didn't punch back. This is a cultural problem. Baby boomers generally don't like to be confrontational. And in fact, one of the things that drives many of the Democrats, even those who really agree with Lynn on most every policy issue, one of the things that drives them crazy is that every time Lynn speaks, He's picking a fight. And it's always the right fight. It's always at that particular precise moment directed at the right target. You know, it's funny. Sometimes people say, gee whiz, 2 weeks ago you were attacking Felix Rohatyn. Now you're back attacking Bush and Cheney. Make up your mind. No. It's all the same thing. This is, again, this idea of dynamics, that a situation is fluid. It's moving quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Flanks change, but certain universal characteristics of the situation don't change at all. These guys are all bums. You know, I had to laugh because when Rumsfeld, a couple of weeks back, launched his own little McCarthyite assault against the Democrats and equated them with those in the 30s who were soft and who were the appeasers of Hitler, we went right back. You know, Lynn shot back and said, Mr. President, don't forget your grandfather. He wasn't just an appeaser. He was a financier of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And some Democrats got uncomfortable about that because they know that Prescott Bush Sr., the grandfather of the president, who financed the Nazi Party through the Union Banking Corporation, which was the American banking arm of the Thyssen interests in Germany, was a partner of Averell Harriman, who was a prominent Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got people inside the Democratic Party who've got the same, literally, Nazi appeasement, Nazi collaboration stench on their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you're willing to be honest about history, you're never going to be able to correct it.
This is the same grouping that in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s in the Democratic Party switched from opposition to free trade and globalization into an embrace of it around, in particular, Albert Gore.
Exactly. You know, you've got this whole Truman revival going on right now around the argument that Truman was a tough guy. He dropped the bombs on Japan. Then he turned around and got into a Cold War with the Soviets. And the fact of the matter is, it was bad policy. It overturned the entire post-war outlook and perspective of Franklin Roosevelt. It wasted 50 years locked into Cold War, threat of nuclear war, division of the world, disinvestment, and destruction of major parts of the world that became battlegrounds for Cold War surrogate conflicts. Africa, a big part of what was done to turn Africa into a field of genocide, was done under the umbrella of the Cold War. The U.S. should have been on the side of liberation movements in Africa that were fighting for independence against the British and the French and the Dutch and the Belgian colonials.
So we're paying the price today for that treachery against the FDR tradition.
That's right. And therefore, the healthiest thing for the Democratic Party to do is to cast off the Truman image and go back to FDR. In fact, you know, Lynn was commenting that the LaRouche Political Action Committee pamphlet that has now been put out is called The End of the Truman Era.
Right.
Lynn said the only other appropriate title, but it was less combative, would have been The Rebirth of the FDR Tradition, which is the other thing that LaRouche and our entire movement is all about. So you've got to force this Truman issue. And, you know, the other thing that people really reacted to during the September 6th LaRouche webcast from Berlin was his discussion about López Obrador and the fact that López Obrador is mobilizing the forgotten men and women of Mexico, the lower 80%. And you see a clear demonstration there of what the potential is. in the population, if you mobilize them around economic justice, economic growth, and truth.
And as Lyndon LaRouche pointed out today, given the way the Republicans are trying to demagogue the immigration issue, this is an important point for the Democrats and Americans to take up, because if López Obrador is defeated and Calderón is imposed in Mexico as the new president, it will probably drive 10 million more Mexicans to the United States and lead to a militarization of the border. We may get to that in next week's show, and given that it's coming to a head in Mexico with the Independence Day upon us. Now, Jeff, I want to come back to the youth in just a moment. Ed and Dennis, if you have questions for Jeff, we'll take them up. But I just wanted to ask you, from your recent trips to Berlin, where you've participated in some of these seminars with Mr. LaRouche, and then even more so this last one, the international participation and the growing recognition of Lynn's role as a public voice in the United States among intellectuals and political leaders in Russia, China, India, throughout the Arab world, and now increasingly in Europe as well. What can you tell us on this?
Well, I can tell you that at the end of October, by popular demand and also by strategic necessity, Mr. LaRouche will be doing another international webcast from Berlin, broadcast into Washington, and we anticipate even larger and more high-level participation from leading people in Russia, China, India, and other parts of the world. I think that over the course of the next several weeks, Mr. LaRouche, despite his busy travel schedule, will be sitting down and answering all of the questions that came in, that really flooded into the webcast on September 6th, but which there was no time to answer during the course of the event. Probably there are 100 questions that came in from leading people all over the world, and Mr. LaRouche will be answering all of those questions. So in effect, we're going to have an ongoing dialogue leading right into the event sometime in the last few days of October. Now, I think bear in mind that we'll be in a very different situation by the end of October than we were in on September 6th, because the accelerating collapse of the automobile manufacturing sector inside the United States, the prospects of a blowout of the housing bubble in the United States, and the prospect of a collapse of the dollar causing chain reaction economic and monetary explosions all over the planet, could very well already have happened by the time that we get to the end of October in the next webcast. So again, we're going to be conducting an ongoing live dialogue as this crisis itself is playing out.
Well, so people should pay attention to the LaRouche Pack .com website and LaRouchePub.com for the definitive announcement of the date of the next webcast, but also to stay in touch on a day-to-day basis. And again, I would encourage people to pick up a copy of the September 6th webcast transcript by calling 800-929-7566. And you can order extras of these. You can take them around, take them to your workplace, to your neighborhood. This is the discussion of history and current history. That is not just history as some event in the past that may have some vague connection to the present, but that we are shaping the ongoing unfolding of history through our own discussions, through our activity. And if you're not in touch with Lyndon LaRouche, you don't know where you are in current history. And that's a fact. People may not like it, but that's a fact. So we have a little more than 10 minutes. Let's go back to Ed and Dennis. If you have any questions for Jeff or other comments, Ed?
Yeah, Harley, speaking of history, I was wondering what Jeff's thoughts were on the cycle of history that Lynn led the discussion at the webcast with, because Lynn, in one case, I think it was in 2004, wrote a pamphlet called A Turning Point in History, where he went through the long-term cycle of the British East India Company, that establishment of that.
Right, 1763.
Yeah, so now, but then in the recent paper, Reanimating the Economy, he laid out a bunch of cycles and sub-cycles of things like this, and I'm curious about why Lynn is concentrating on this particular cycle that he discussed in the webcast. And one of the things that was posed in discussion on this was because of Lynn's particular role in it, him being an actual figure trying to shape the direction of these things. But I was just curious about what your thoughts were on that.
Well, for one thing, Lynn purposely lunged the webcast with the discussion of Truman, because this is an existential question for the Democratic Party. And even though he was speaking from Berlin and was talking about a 50-year perspective of economic development centered in Eurasia, but also a parallel process in the Americas, and the two vectored into Africa, he was very much focused on the strategic importance of the upcoming elections in the U.S., and he used the event of September 6th to intervene to shape the issues and define the fault lines for the election. So I think he's got very much in mind the fact that we've got to get a different composition of the Congress. For one thing, I know my own view is that it's absolutely vital that the Democrats take control of one or both houses of Congress, because under our constitutional system, there is a great danger of subversion when one party controls the presidency, the Congress, and the courts. So he wanted to make the point about Truman to force that crisis inside the Democratic Party by counterposing Roosevelt and Truman as diametrically opposite and incompatible forces. The second thing is that it happens to be the case that the phase of current history that began with Roosevelt's death represents a coherent whole. And we're now reaching the end of that particular cycle, which is why we see the financial oligarchy using the instrumentality of the Bush presidency, among other things, to go for fascism and to go for war, because their system, the post-Roosevelt system, both in its distorted Bretton Woods phase and then its even more virulent post-Bretton Woods phase, is now reached the end. And therefore, they have to go for fascism, war, and the destruction of the nation-state system as a whole. So I think you could easily take the turning point of the death of Roosevelt and the succession of Truman as a turning point in history, and you'd be absolutely right, because it was. It was a decisive moment. You could also look back at the assassination of William McKinley.
Mm-hmm.
And the emergence of Teddy Roosevelt, the first really imperial 20th century American president. And we've had a whole succession that was interrupted by Franklin Roosevelt and then to a certain similar extent by Eisenhower. So these cycles have subsumed cycles within them. You do have the phase shift of 1763 when Lord Shelburne and others really launched Britain under the East India Company as the Venetian model and launched what Mr. LaRouche calls Anglo-Dutch liberalism from that point on. So we've been in a historic battle since that moment against Venetian-modeled Anglo-Dutch liberalism, and that was what the American Revolution was actually fought against.
Mm-hmm.
So you could also say that we're in a critical moment in the cycle of history where the very survival of the United States as the constitutional republic it was founded to be is also jeopardized.
Well, that's precisely why it becomes possible to, provided the Democrats listen to Lyndon LaRouche, to take both houses, both the House and the Senate, which would then create the immediate prospect for impeachment proceedings against this most unlawful and arrogantly violent toward the Constitution administration. We have a little less than 4 minutes. Dennis, I want to give you a chance if you have another question for Jeff.
Sure. I was remembering back to the cadre school, Jeff, you were at in Sacramento this past spring. And you made a hypothesis, a really unique hypothesis, saying that the American Revolution took approximately about, you know, from 1630 till about the time of the Revolution to prepare a population for that type of revolution, that type of change with our Constitution, which and that, how that shifted the whole global picture of what governments were capable of doing. And in that context, I'm thinking the role of the LaRouche Youth Movement in creating a shift in this population we live in today, given all the operations run against the baby boomer generation, the CCF, because we oftentimes get on the streets people saying people aren't ready for these types of things. And you can see people ready for a shift, people ready for a new getting rid of Bush, pulling out of Iraq. But I was just wondering your thoughts on this idea of really shaping, preparing a population for this type of political change.
Well, look, two things. One is that it's kind of a continuation of Ed's question from just a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that after the British were defeated in the Civil War, in the United States, they shifted strategy. They could no longer hope to defeat the United States militarily. They shifted to a policy of cultural warfare to try to destroy the United States from within. And much of the 20th century is a history of British efforts through the Frankfurt School, through the destruction of education, through a million different things, to subvert the culture. The paradigm shift of the baby boomer generation is the most glaring example of that. But still, through all of this, there is a certain cultural impulse among Americans, which very much goes back to the Constitution and the idea that the sovereignty of the government derives from the will of the people, and that the purpose of government is the general welfare. These ideas tend to live on because they're embedded deeply in our culture. The idea of progress is embedded deeply in our culture. So I think one of my real hate figures of the 20th century, Winston Churchill, happened to have made a comment that was a begrudging acknowledgement of this unique character of the American people and the American culture. He said, you have to hand it to the Americans. They always get it right, but only after everything else has failed. And I think we've reached a moment where everything else has failed to such an extent that if we do the organizing right, we will tap into this deep vein of this American constitutional tradition.
And Jeff, we're
and
out of time, but that's a good thought to end on. Jeff, thank you. Ed and Dennis, thank you. This is the LaRue Show for September 16th, 2006.